There are things you can replace and others you cannot. The time has come to weigh those things. That's Grateful Dead. It's Grateful Dead night at Rogers Center. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. In addition to Grateful Dead night down at the ballpark tonight, where if you have one of those special tickets, you can get the Grateful Dead Bear Blue Jays bucket hat, which I'm not a bucket hat guy. I have a large head. It's not going to be a good look for me. It's a cool piece of merch, though, as was the tie-dye Blue Jay Bear last year on Grateful Dead night. So yeah, we're going Grateful Dead lyric. We'll talk about some Bowden Francis, which feels spiritually similar today. A couple other quick notes about baseball this weekend. There was a lot going on last night. On a night the Jays were off, by the way, Yankees walked off the Red Sox walk-offs two nights in a row for the Yankees, in part because their bullpen's bad, but in part because their hitters are very, very good. It is Roberto Clemente Day on Sunday. That is always important to the players. Particularly, you'll see someone of Puerto Rican descent like Jose Berríos do something special on that day. A lot of the players will be in Clemente, either his jersey number or patches and things like that. Chris Bassitt is the Blue Jays nominee for the Roberto Clemente Award, which recognizes service in the community and beyond baseball and things like that for the work that Chris Bassitt and his wife have done with Jays Care Foundation this year and outside of that as well. Today is also Roberto Clemente Day of Service. That's mostly a Pittsburgh Pirates thing because Clemente was, of course, a Pirate, but you might see stuff pop up around Major League Baseball with respect to that as well. Last night, if you're watching Sox-Yankees, by the way, that before that walk-off, you would have saw Ken Rosenthal on Fox Sports in a bow tie, which, of course, he always does, and they are always themed, and they're always in honor of some cause or some person. A little close to home last night in that he wore one for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and specifically shouted out our colleague Jamie Campbell with that one. So you can check out lls.org for more about Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, but a nice gesture from Ken Rosenthal on that broadcast. And yeah, the Jays were off, so it took in a little Red Sox Yankees, took in a little Bills Dolphins as well. But my main takeaway from that is, good God, I can't believe the Jaguars lost to that Dolphins team. Ugly, ugly stuff. Let's get the opposite of ugly. Let's get our beautiful friend Keegan Matheson on the line of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Keegan, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Blake. How you doing?
I'm good, man. It's, off night for the Jays in week two of the NFL when there's a primetime. The timing was good. I imagine the Ernie Clements of the world appreciated the timing as well. Good for all of us to get a Thursday night off here down the stretch.
God bless, man. It's always a battle, like trying to get these early NFL games in. Like this Sunday, I'll try to write a good story. I'll also try to write a quick story and get home for that 4 o'clock, 4:30 slate. So it's a beautiful, beautiful time of year. You know, NFL is the thing I still get to be a fan of. And then, you know, as a Packers fan, that's not been a great life so far this week. I've been a pretty good life overall, but it's a fun time, man. I get to understand baseball fandom again because I get unhinged and I kind of fly off the handle myself.
Yeah, but you do that one day a week, which is the nice thing about football, obviously, right? Well, I mean, I know there were four primetime games last week, so it was more nights a week. But generally, it's a one day a week fly off the handle. Like, you're only going to get mad about Malik Willis once this week rather than, you know, a Yankee fan who has watched Clay Holmes six times this week, you know?
I hope so. I hope I only get mad about Malik Willis one time at the very most. But it's, coming off of that opening Packers loss, where I watched the video of Jordan Love's knee shift about 700 times, closer and closer to my face each time, I thought, man, I respect these baseball fans who can do this every night because I don't have the heart for it.
Well, I would prefer to be doing that in baseball right now. I prefer to be living and dying by outcomes instead of just being like, Bowden Francis took a no-hitter into the ninth. That's awesome. Who cares really what happens beyond that? Obviously, you would like guys to play better, but, you know, the difference between a 3-2 loss and a 6-2 loss in a game like that is really not all that notable. What was notable, we'll take it back to baseball here, was Bowden Francis chasing a no-hitter once again. I asked you this about Dalton Varsho maybe a month ago because Varsho kept doing crazy things. It was like the only positive other than Vlad that we had in July. Now it's Bowden Francis's turn. I don't get tired of talking about it or rewriting that story. No. Are you running out of Bowden superlatives?
No, because he's an interesting dude.
Yeah.
And covering an interesting player. In my job, that's what I care about. I don't care who wins or loses. I care that something cool happens. And that there's an interesting person to talk to, and Bowden Francis is kind of nailing that lately. And I was thinking off the top, Blake, the first time I ever interviewed Bowden Francis, and I promise I'll tie this back to what we were talking about. It was, I believe, last spring. And there's a lot of days in spring training where the only people there covering the team are me and maybe Shy or BNS. And if it's a Jose Berríos or Kevin Gausman start day, yeah, absolutely. They'll pitch two innings. I'll talk to them. Sure thing. There are other days where maybe it's a Wes Parsons or Mitch White, and I say, yeah, I don't need it today. That's all right. I remember Bowden Francis had a really good spring outing. And I said, you know what? I haven't talked to this guy yet. I'm not sure if I'm going to write about it, but I want to respect this guy and set up an interview and see what he's feeling. And he was wearing a Grateful Dead shirt when he walked out. And it was a torn up vintage Grateful Dead shirt.
Of course it was.
And I remember him walking out and he started talking about, and this would have been last year because he was coming off of winter ball where he pitched in Puerto Rico, and started talking about the experience he had there and connecting mind to body to universe to pitching. And it was fascinating. And I think everyone is seeing that now quite regularly in Bowden. He's a thoughtful guy. And we're seeing on the mound, Blake, what a lot of people told us we would be seeing in spring training. I don't mean me. I mean pitchers. I mean Pete Walker, a lot of people in this organization, why they were so high on Bowden. And it did not work early on. I mean, obviously, two starts in the rotation before Yariel Rodriguez came in. But he has been fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And what I like about these two near-miss no-hitters, Blake, is that he did it in different ways. One time, he looked pretty dominant. This last time, if you walked past the TV and watched one batter, you weren't going to say, holy moly, look at this guy. But he figured it out. And I think he's making the adjustments. Anybody can come up and have a good start. But it's about making those adjustments. And I think we're starting to see that from Bowden right now. And that's where this really gets exciting, when you can start to think long term.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, this is the part of the year that the Blue Jays are in, is thinking long term. And unfortunately, you know, there's been a lot of pitcher churn that we could talk about after that has not resulted in anything that will be meaningful to 2025. We are, by the way, we're through the looking glass when you're claiming low strikeout Marlins cast-off relievers. No disrespect to Brett DeGuess.
One of these guys has got to work. Someday, one of these guys.
I mean, some point, someone becomes Jeff Hoffman last year for the Phillies, but it has not happened yet for, I believe it's 11 pitchers the Blue Jays have claimed or purchased since the start of the season and have been on the 40-man. And, yeah, it's bleak. Anyway, so Bowden Francis does apply to the future. So obviously, the more sample we have, the more data of him doing this, him being able to do it. Hey, I feel fatigued today. Hey, I don't have my best stuff today. Can I get through it? Those are all important data points. Probably only going to have two starts the rest of the way here. There are 15 games left, and they'll probably do a sixth man or a bullpen day here and there or whatever. What are you looking at? Is there anything over these last couple other than just like get to the finish line healthy?
That's about it at this point, honestly. I don't think there's enough time for anyone to show you something entirely new. Now, sure, a hitter could go 20 for 30 down the stretch. A pitcher could have a couple of shutout outings, but there's not much runway left to work with. So I think even using Bowden Francis as the example for all of this, just get out of it. You get through the season, get to the end of this. I think a lot of these, even young players especially, have shown flashes. I don't think they're going to change a lot of minds down the stretch. And this is some valuable experience. The more competitive teams they play, the better. Playing another game against the A's or something at this time of year doesn't matter for anybody. But if the Blue Jays can take a few positives, and like Bowden Francis, I mean, my goodness, you're not going to find a better example, maybe in baseball, of a guy who is helping himself for next year. And they just need to keep this going. Bowden, especially with his workload this year, is really encouraging. He seems to be holding up well. He's a big built guy, natural for a starter, but that workload's getting into a pretty exciting place, frankly, and a place I didn't think it would be getting to.
Yeah, he's at 112 innings now, and he's thrown, you know, 130 back in the past, 140 even, I think, in 2019. So he's done this before, but if you're looking at, you know, John Schneider has talked about Yariel for next year. And like, even if he's a starter, you know, that number's probably around like 150 at the very high end. And that's probably high, coming off zero and then 100 and 3 years before that of being a multi-inning or high leverage relief guy. So if you're talking Bowden Francis and you're already up to 130-ish this year. You can, you know, I think you can go into next year. He's 29 years old at this point next season. He's pitched 130, 140 innings before. He's a big dude. I don't think you have to worry about it at all, which is pretty encouraging. When it comes to how much Bowden has changed, like four starts ago, I would have said, yeah, it's really good. It's obviously great if he's good from here on out, but you know, there are enough holes on this team that you can't be like, well, Bowden Francis has a rotation spot locked down for sure. Each successive start, you're like a little bit more, you know what? Yeah. I'd be fine with it. Yeah, you know what? I'd be fine with it. Where are you in terms of the Jays' overall starting pitching depth heading into next year with, you know, Jake Blass hasn't looked the best at AAA, but obviously he's a young guy. Yariel Rodriguez, you know, the innings issue, that, and he's not going to pitch a ton the rest of the way here. And then your Manoahs, Tiedemanns, et cetera, are late season considerations, if anything at all. Bowden Francis has obviously changed us a little bit, but are you still feeling that, you know, they'll, in addition to the power bats they need, they're going to have to look at the starting rotation as well?
Yeah, that depth group is still not good enough. And it's benefiting greatly from the fact that Bowden Francis is doing this. If Bowden Francis had not done this, we'd be talking about you need multiple legitimate MLB pitchers next year. If you go into next year with the three veterans in Bassett, Gosman, and Berríos, when you have Francis, you have Rodriguez, that's a good start. If you get an inning at all from Manoah or Tiedemann at the end of the year, fantastic. Everyone's happy. Maybe Manoah gets back. Maybe Tiedemann comes back, a late rush to a bullpen roll or something, but you can't bet on that. Having Jake Blass there is really important. That's a first level of defense. And we've talked about this a lot over the years, Blake. The Blue Jays, I always hesitate to say lucky because there's an arc to this, to staying healthy and on the field. But they have been fortunate that they have not needed to go 8, 9, 10, 11 pitchers deep. A lot of teams need to do that. Eventually, the Blue Jays are going to have to do that. Maybe it's next year. It hasn't been the last couple of years because Ross Stripling saved them. Hyunjin Ryu came back and saved them. They've always had one guy that's been able to step in this year, Bowden Francis. They haven't had to go that third, fourth, fifth level down in depth. It's going to happen sooner than later. All of those veteran pitchers are getting 1 year older and 1 year closer to the end for them. So it's an important thing for the Blue Jays to target. It's also a very difficult thing to acquire. Now, this organization should have done a better job of that over the last few years. But there's a reason pitching is so expensive. And you cannot go out onto the open market and just sign a guy to be your number seven because another team is going to offer him a job in the rotation. So I think, Blake, this is probably where the trade market comes in, maybe this offseason, bullpen as well. But rotation, trying to turn maybe some of this excess infield depth into a starter. But they need more. They absolutely need more. And this team, this organization cannot allow itself to go into next year with that risk. Because even if they improve the lineup, they improve the bullpen, which both got to happen. We're talking about a lot of needs. You can't have that one thing that can tank it all. And a lack of rotation depth is extremely dangerous. They've gotten fortunate. It has not bit them the last couple of years. It's going to bite them eventually.
It is, especially as, you know, you get deeper into the 30s. I mean, Chris Bassett talked about this with Shai Davidi and Arden Zwelling a while back after that podcast appearance where he needed to clarify comments. He's like, yeah, the reality is Chris Bassett is 36 and is not getting younger. Kevin Gausman has the miles on his odometer that he has. Jose Berríos has pitched more than, like, almost anyone in baseball since he came to the majors. Those are real factors, and, like, those guys deserve a world of credit for staying healthy and being durable, but you can't. You can't bank on it forever. And the other thing that I've noted a couple times, and again, this is more of a, you know, November conversation, but if you address the starting pitching depth, now, like you said, you can't sign someone to be your seventh starter and be like, hey, bud, you're going to AAA and you're there if we need. But if you address starting pitching depth and a guy or two lose out on the rotation, that helps you address the bullpen in a way that if you spend on the bullpen, you can't then, you know, like Tanner Scott is not going to be able to fill in as a starter for you. You know, whereas, hey, you sign, I don't know, this year's Michael Lorenzen, Yariel Rodriguez beats him out. Well, okay, you've got your multi-inning bullpen guy. You've got your Ryan Yarbrough back there. But, you know, anyway, there are a lot of ways to do this. And you're never, there's never going to be a scenario where they add starting pitching. I'm like, well, that wasn't necessary. Never happened. There's never been a team in the history of baseball. Even like the Astros right now, I've seen people be like, well, they've got six starters. What are they going to do in the playoffs? I don't know, have six starters that have a better bullpen, yeah, and like they're going to have good pitching. That's what they're going to do in the playoffs. Sorry to Justin Verlander that maybe you're, you know, maybe you're a reliever now. Okay, last one on Bowden Francis. Yeah. You tweeted this number out. The Blue Jays have played 7,534 games in the history of their franchise. They have a single no-hitter. The Colorado Rockies and Tampa Bay Rays are the only other team franchises in baseball who only have a single no-hitter. Obviously, the answer to this is mostly just randomness or whatever. The Jays have had good pitching. They have had some Hall of Fame-level pitching. Dave Steeb, Roger Clemens, Roy Halladay. What do you think? What do you think it is? Like, we've had those two. We had the Brandon Morrow near miss, the Dustin McGowan near miss. What's going on here?
It's so strange. And there's a curse of some sort, and I don't know how to describe it. Dave Steeb's no-hitter was a few days before I was born. And for people watching us on TV right now, you can see my face. This is how long it's been right here. It's been a while. And the near misses for even Steeb. I know it's written and talked about a lot, but I can't believe, Blake, that he lost two no-hitters in his final two starts of a season on the final out. Like, that had to be the most miserable offseason of all time. I would have put on 100 pounds that offseason and not worked out once. That had to be miserable for Dave Steeb. But it's a great story because he finally did it a couple of years later. That's why this whole Bowden Francis story is, you hope that someday he does this and stays on that Steeb path. There's something cursed about it. And that's what makes this story so fascinating. If the Blue Jays had six no-hitters in their history, which would be a very normal number, then these Bowden Francis things would be interesting, but not much more than that. There's something almost becoming sort of mythical about a no-hitter in Toronto. And even when Bowden Francis is getting into the ninth, Blue Jays fans have seen this over and over. And now that Francis has done it, Blake, this is a new generation of Blue Jays fans who have that ninth-inning heartbreak. Steeb did it. You had the Halladay, the Morrow. Now a new generation of fans, younger fans, have their Bowden Francis games they're going to remember. It's got to happen someday. A lot of the time it's luck. A lot of the time when a guy throws a no-hitter, I believe Dave Steeb said this after his. It was not the best he felt. There was luck involved. He said that himself after his own. But it's got to happen someday. Man, it's been interesting, and it's something I'd love to cover someday. Man, each time Bowden Francis was taking those no-hitters deep into the game, I don't typically score a game on paper as I'm writing because I'm busy on a story. But each time I went out and I made sure I slipped a scorecard into my bag just in case this happens. It would be something cool to have, hang on to. It's someday, maybe it will happen. I hope in my lifetime, Blake. What am I, halfway through, you know? I've got half of this thing left. I want to cover a no-hitter. I've covered James Paxton. I've covered Justin Verlander doing it against the Blue Jays. It happens to them a lot. But Lord, they are due. They're due.
So not covered one, I haven't been at any. When the Jays have been no-hit, I wasn't there. I was at both of these Bowden Francis ones. I was at both of those as a fan, by the way, not as media. And then I was at the Dustin McGowan one. And like the Roy Halladay, Bobby Higginson one, you mentioned like this generation has theirs now. Like Taylor Ward is Bobby Higginson for, I don't know, what do we call young people? Gen Z? Is that what they are now? Taylor Ward is Gen Z Bobby Higginson.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I have like a core memory with my late grandfather of that Roy Halladay, Bobby Higginson one. So yeah, it's cool that as much as it sucks that it didn't happen, it is cool to think that there are people making associations with this team and this franchise and a guy like Bowden Francis through something like that. Okay, looking forward here, there are 15 games to play still. You mentioned, hey, it's good for them to play against good teams and, you know, test yourself. Yep. There are none left. They are, you know, they've got three against the Red Sox who are, like, barely in the wild card race still and probably shouldn't be if any of these central teams were playing well. But it's 15 games against teams that are, you know, in the same spot the Jays are or even lower. So in terms of what we're looking for, like you laid it out, there's not a ton there. Probably the headline item the rest of the way will be the return of Bo Bichette at some point. He got into a second rehab game yesterday, played six innings at short, went 1-for-3. What are you looking for from a Bo Bichette return, you know, probably in Texas next week? And are you going, by the way? Is that your last trip of the season?
I'm in Texas, baby. Yeah. I do not get to go to my beloved Trop. I got a wedding to go to that weekend, but Texas, it's of the many road trips in MLB, it's one of them, definitely. this feels, man, Blake, this really feels like the fake late run. The Blue Jays finish 81-81 or something down the stretch. It's so teed up for that. Bichette coming back is really important. I would compare this to Jordan Romano when he was looking like he might come back. And in Romano's case, I said, I don't know if that matters. And if it matters to Jordan, great. But I don't think the Blue Jays need to see something different. There's no point to getting him into a few games. With Bo, all along, I really believed that there's value to this. And I think John Schneider said it well the other day, that if Bo did not come back, he'd go crazy all offseason. You hear it about a lot of players that they live and breathe baseball. Well, Bo sleeps it and drinks it and everything else. He's a baseball nut. It's what makes him good when he is at his best. And this has been such a tough year for Bichette. The multiple calf injuries, the performance, which is not up to his standard whatsoever. He's hard on himself. He's spoken about that in the past. John Schneider's spoken about it a lot, knowing him back to when he was 17, 18 years old. He holds himself to these very high standards, and this is an opportunity for him just to get back to being himself, to go into the offseason on a high note. And Bichette, I mean, no MLB players sit at home and get fat in the offseason anymore. That's not how this works, but Bichette especially. I mean, I'm assuming he doesn't even take a day off. So this will send him into whatever he's doing next on a better note, ideally, for the Blue Jays. And I know this season has soured a lot of people, and I get it. It's been a bad one. I would still bet on Bichette next year. He's going to be the most motivated player in Major League Baseball. I guarantee it. And coming into this year, I thought Bichette would get maybe some back-end MVP votes. He'd get that 8th, 9th, 10th finish. I'm probably going to say the same thing next year. And like you say, Blake, no motivation better than free agency coming around the corner. And when you include pride in all of that and the standards Bichette holds himself to, I think he's going to be a man on fire next spring. I really, really do. And getting back into this, just being normal for a couple weeks, I think is an important part of that.
I would love to be normal at some point. That'd be great.
Oh, please. I'm begging.
But yeah, you're right. Like it's easy to be negative about the year Bo Bichette had. There's no other way to do it, really. But this is a guy who, you know, I mentioned it the other day, even in his partial seasons when he was 21, like he hit 290 or better every single year. He led the American League in hits 2 years in a row. He, to your point, he received MVP votes somewhere on the ballot in each of the last three seasons, finished 12th, 11th, and 16th. That's not, you know, top five in the MVP, but that's someone thought you were a very valuable player every single year, 3 years in a row. So, and then, you know, there's the pride element. There's the I want to contribute to the team element. And then there's the if I repeat 2024, I've cost myself nine figures worth of money element. Like you don't want to, if you repeat 2024, like you're probably still getting like the Marcus Semien 2021 deal, but you're not getting the Corey Seager deal or anything near that. You're not getting the Marcus Semien after that year deal. A lot on the line there. Okay, last one for you, Keegan. You and I were there early when the Blue Jays were taking their team photo the other day. How many of those guys are left for next year's team photo?
Oh, boy. I think I went back to the opening day roster, and I think only half, so 13 opening day guys from this April were here for that team photo. And even reading through that opening day lineup, Blake, I remember it was down in Tampa. I don't remember that. I don't remember the man I was. I don't remember half of the names. I don't think many are. Bullpen especially. My God, that's going to change. They'll have to – whatever musical chairs game happens in the infield, we'll see. I think when I arrive in beautiful Dunedin, Florida, next February, which is already sending a shiver up my spine to think about, I think I'm going to have to introduce myself to a lot of people. Is probably the best way to say it.
Yeah, that's, which is fun. It's new stories. It's new stuff to write. It's hopefully means a better roster because, you mentioned earlier all the holes they have to fill. Well, they've won 69 games right now. They got to find 20 extra wins somewhere. So that's going to mean some new faces. Keegan, always great to see your face. Have a wonderful weekend at the ballpark. And good luck to your Packers with Malik Willis, buddy.
Can't get any worse, baby. Appreciate you. We'll see you soon, Blake.
Keegan Mathison of MLB.com and BlueJays.com. And you can tell he's not entirely locked in on the NFL season from a fan perspective yet, because no fan has ever said it can't get any worse. and meant it. It can always get worse, man. It can always, always, always get worse. Like you root for the Jaguars and they spend 2 days teasing this big announcement, and it's just that they're doing a marketing thing calling it Trevor Bank Field. Underwhelming. Win a game. Beat that Dolphins team, please. Well, obviously that was last week now, but they really, really, really should have beaten that Dolphins team. Anyway, the Blue Jays should be competitive against the St. Louis Cardinals. They're doing the thing again where we don't have probable pitchers, even though we know who would be on turn. The Jays had an off day, so they're coming out of that. They have another off day Monday, so they can keep everyone on pretty good rest here, but they have decided so far not to announce their starters. If everyone's on turn, it'll be Gausman, Berríos, Yariel against Eric Fetty, Kyle Gibson, Miles Michaelis. But Eric Fetty is the only one of those names on either side that's confirmed right now. Couple notes from AAA. I mentioned Bobichek got into six innings yesterday at short, went 1-for-3, turned a double play. He'll be presumably back in there today, maybe as designated hitter. Alan Rodon stayed hot with a homer down there. And Jonathan Clase has now stole six bases in his last six games and four in his last three. So maybe things starting to click there a little bit. Still not hitting for a great average, but every time he's on base, he's running, which is fun. Final weekend of the season for AA New Hampshire Fisher Cats, and game three tonight for the Vancouver Canadiens in their best 3-of-5 Northwest League championship. Games 3, 4, and 5 go Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The series is tied 1-1 right now. So we'll update you on that on Monday. We'll try to talk to someone from that team sometime next week. But yeah, if you're kicking around and want to fire up MILB TV this weekend, it's a good one for it because the Canadiens, big couple games, looking to repeat as champs. Let's take a break. When we go back, we'll talk to John Becker of Fangraphs. We will talk to David Singh of Sportsnet about a really great story he wrote about Francisco Lindor being a sort of mentor for Blue Jays prospect Arjun Namala. That's all next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action tonight, 7:07 at Rogers Center. They will play the St. Louis Cardinals, who are also not relevant to the playoff picture and thought that maybe they would be. They went out and traded for Eric Fetty at the trade deadline. They are a pretty veteran team here in the last couple years of, well, the last year of Paul Goldschmidt. You're deep into that Nolan Arenado contract into his 30s. You've got a pretty veteran pitching staff. They did not expect to be here. Anyway, we'll get to know them a little later in the show. Katie Wu will join us. We got a loaded show today. Esteban Rivera will be on. David Singh is going to come on in a little bit to talk about his Francisco Lindor, Arjun Namala story. But let's talk to John Becker of Fangraphs, and let's start with a very, very different prospect story. John, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Great, Blake. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So last night, a story comes down. And I wish I had Kyler McDaniel on the show earlier in the week. I wish so badly that our timing had lined up for us to talk about this with him. Minnesota Twins cut prospect Derek Bender, who was a top 200 pick just a couple weeks ago, because he is alleged to have given the opposing team what pitches were coming. Now, my head immediately went to Bull Durham, where Crash Davis is doing that to teach a lesson to Nuke LaLoosh. This is obviously not that. This was, I don't want to play anymore. I want the season to be over. Man, I know you tweeted about it a little bit, but what did you make of this story? This is one of the weirder baseball stories I can remember.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to speculate on any of his reasons beyond what was in the article, but, you know, I can understand the idea of like, look, it's your first pro season. Maybe you're away from family for longer than you've ever been before in your life, and you just want to go home. And yeah, I'm sure that's a common sentiment in minor league clubhouses of like, look, I'm ready for the off season. I'm ready to start prepping for next year. I'm ready to just, you know, be back with family. But it's a completely different thing to take that into the game with you. And you know, as the catcher, you're supposed to be the leader of the team. So to then, you know, say, oh, fastball, slider, curveball is the pitches, you know, 30 feet away from home plate is one of the most bizarre baseball stories in recent memory, for sure. Again, it's one thing to have that sentiment, but to basically throw games because you're just ready to go home is extremely bizarre. And I would be pretty surprised if he signed anywhere else, maybe not even just not affiliated ball. I don't know a team on earth who would maybe want that around, but we'll see what's next for him.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because, again, he was a top 200 pick not very long ago. People talked about him as an interesting prospect, both on the field and off the field. But yeah, it's hard to come back from this. Like, we just went through on the Raptors side, the Jontay Porter situation, where he wasn't necessarily throwing games, but he was depressing his own stats for the purposes of a betting scandal. That is something you probably can't come back from. Giving away pitches, like, how would another pitcher ever trust that guy? But again, this is sports, and like, he was a reasonable prospect. Like, I don't know. I don't think it would be too surprising to see a couple years from now he get another shot and hey, I learned from it, etc., because he was an interesting prospect. Let's talk about an interesting prospect who is not going to get cut, is very, very good, and made his debut last night. Kumar Rocker debuted for the Rangers. How exciting was that for you? What'd you make of his first go around?
It was awesome. I mean, he had sort of fallen off the radar. I mean, certainly a prospect, but not a top 100 type, just based on how he had pitched in his first minor league action last season. But I mean, man, the slider is about as good as I've seen from a prospect immediately going to the majors. It reminds me a lot of Dylan Cease's slider and just that late sharp downward movement. His command looked pretty good. He got a little inefficient towards the end there with a couple of walks, but I mean, he looks like the real deal, and that's a huge building block to have for next season, along with Jacob DeGrom in that starting rotation. And DeGrom starts, I believe, tomorrow. Scherzer today. I might have those flipped, but that's a very fun three games.
Yeah, and it's crazy with Rocker, where like it feels like this has been a long story. He was the number three pick like 2 years ago. It's not like I would have guessed, given how winding the road has been, I would have guessed in my memory, I was like, yeah, 2021, maybe even 2020. But it was 2 years ago that he was the number three pick and got like a $5 million bonus. I get that he just like hasn't pitched very much, but it's nasty. And the minor league numbers this year in AA and AAA, small sample, but nasty there as well. So that's fun. And yeah, they'll get Jacob DeGrom back. They'll get Max Scherzer back this weekend. Look, this is probably how a few teams in the American League feel. I certainly feel like it about the Blue Jays. I would imagine Red Sox and Mariners fans feel the same. But if the Rangers could have just been like a little bit less bad, like the AL Central teams have left the wild card open, the Rangers are getting these three pitchers back. I don't know. I feel like the Rangers just like aren't that far off despite how bad this season's been for them.
No, they're not. I mean, I think they're running out of time for this season, but they're really building a good foundation for next season. And I think that was really the goal as soon as it was realized, I think around like, let's say mid-August, that they just weren't going to make the playoffs this year is, you know, what can we get out of Wyatt Langford for the rest of the season? What pitchers will we have coming back healthy? Will, you know, Jack Leiter improve upon his first stint in the majors, which he has in his second stint, but there wasn't really any other direction to go. So yeah, I mean, they're in evaluation mode, and well, they've completely underwhelmed everyone's expectations. The reigning World Series champs, obviously, you expect them to, you know, at least make the playoffs and probably go far as the reigning World Series champs, but I like to think that they're really well set up for next year. And I know we all said that this year, but, you know, it's another year of experience in the bigs for Wyatt Langford. Rocker, I think, is a little ahead of schedule and so on.
Yeah. And like these things happen sometimes, right? Like it's obviously, it's not how regression works that, oh, everything went wrong this year, so everything will go right next year. That's not exactly how it works. Unless you're the San Diego Padres. That's exactly how it's played out. Hey, you had like plus 60 run differential and couldn't ever win a game last year. This year, team of destiny vibes. I use the Padres as an example because it's extreme and because I wanted to talk to you about the piece you have up at FanGraphs this morning. So your latest top of the order, which is a tremendous series twice a week, really, really valuable. But you looked at some of the qualifying offer decisions that teams will face and players will face coming up. And this might be the last time we talk to you this season. So let's talk about it, even though it's early for free agency. And it's crazy that you went through all the guys who could potentially get qualifying offers, who might accept it, who's obviously going to reject it. And Jurickson Profar is, at first I was like, you had him listed as like, he's definitely going to get it and definitely going to reject it. And initially I was like, would he reject it? And then I was looking, I'm like, Yeah, he's had a 4-win season. It's crazy. Yeah. And he made $1 million this year. There is like that whiplash from you took basically the minimum last year to you will probably reject the qualifying offer this year is wild. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of had a Jekyll and Hyde career, honestly, of like top prospect to bust to, okay, he's in the majors for good, but it feels like he almost perfectly alternates between being below average and above average, bouncing around a bunch of different positions to now being settled in as like an okay at best left fielder. So he's had a very fascinating, weird career. And when I was doing the research for this piece, I said in my head, well, you know, do I put Profar in the definite camp? Because in my head, I was like, oh, he isn't great in the second half. But then I looked it up and he's still been like 27% above average since the All-Star break because he's walking and incidentally getting hit by pitches a ton. So, I mean, he's a very solid player who I think the contract he ends up getting will sneak up on a lot of people. I think he's pretty well into that like 3 or 4 year range. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, if Profar sticks around in San Diego, just because that's pretty clear to me that that's where he's most comfortable. He immediately started hitting a lot better there after getting cut by the Rockies last year. Or if he, you know, maybe there's some team out there willing to, quote unquote, overpay based on, you know, what we think he'll get.
Man, what a sentence to say. After being cut by the Rockies, he was almost a -2 win player over 100 games and change with the Rockies, and now is a 4-win guy for the Padres. And like some of that is Jerks and Profar's own randomness, like you highlighted there, very like, hey, he's below replacement level, now he's a 2-win guy, below replacement level, now he's a 2-win guy. But also it's just so on the nose for the Rockies that they took the flyer on him first and he was -2 wins, and then he goes back to San Diego. He's like, 4-win guy again now. It's ridiculous. Okay, so elsewhere on that list of guys who will receive the qualifying offer and reject it, some interesting names, but guys who are going to have a comp pick attached to them. Pretty straightforward list there. Sean Manaea maybe at the lower end, and then Teoscar, Santander, and then the star guys, of course. Then there's this tier of, I don't know, guys. And the most interesting one to me, and you had him in, he'll probably get it and then reject it, but I do think there's probably a little bit of on the fence, is Tyler O'Neill, who walked one off earlier in the week. He's hit 30 home runs this year for the second time, and there is just no track record of him staying healthy. He's played 100 games this year, which is the second highest of his career. What do you make of what Tyler O'Neill's free agent market could be like, given the, you know, the platoon splits and the injury history? But, man, not many guys who can hit the ball for power like him.
Yeah, I think he'll do pretty well qualifying offer or not. I think he could be in that like 3 or 4 year at like, let's say 14 to 16 million a year type contract. But there is a lot of risk with him, with the injuries, with being good against righties and great against lefties, but you're obviously going to face more righties, with a lot of what he's done this year being understandably boosted by Fenway, which is like the ideal ballpark fit for him because he can hit some absolute moonshots over the Green Monster. And of course, you know, defense has been a little bit on the downswing for him. He was a Gold Glover his last completely healthy season and now is okay in both corners. So he's going to be a divisive guy. I think for a lot of other teams, if it was clear, okay, we don't really have a left fielder for next season, then we'll give him the qualifying offer and see what happens. But the Red Sox are in a unique situation where they have Yoshida locked in as the DH. Duran's probably going to slide over to left. Rafaela should be a full-time center fielder because he's much better out there than on the infield where he's helping out right now. And Willier Abreu in right. So if you're the Red Sox, do you want to take the risk that he accepts that and then working out a trade for a guy making $22 million a year isn't super easy? Nor would they want to feel that they like have to trade Abreu or even Rafaela just to make some room. I think that's what would give them pause, maybe more so than who O'Neill is. It's just, do they have a spot for him to risk that kind of money?
And they have a kind of a dual difficult situation there because Nick Pivetta is another name that's, you know, he's fringy. And I think not fringy in the, like, I don't know, even though Nick Pivetta has never quite performed to the level of his peripherals, I'd take 1 year of Nick Pivetta at $21 million. But if you're the Red Sox and you have money committed here and money committed there, and you're also making the Tyler O'Neill risk, the Nick Pivetta situation gets a little, a little interesting. And again, the counter to your point about Tyler O'Neill is like, well, maybe Nick Pivetta would be as good as the strikeout and walk numbers and underlying numbers suggest if he didn't have to pitch in Fenway all the time as a left or as a right-handed pitcher. What do you make of the Pivetta side of the situation? Another guy who just, I think the Red Sox have like two of the more curious, obviously very good players, but hard to peg down exactly what O'Neill and Pivetta will come out of this with.
Yeah, I like Pivetta. I think a lot of people like Pivetta. I think a lot of teams like Pivetta, and I think all of the same camps are probably frustrated with Pivetta. Like, it just feels like he should be this closer to a monster, like 200-plus strikeout guy every season, and whether it's just sort of being mercurial with walks or, as he's dealt with this year, some elbow injury barking. You know, he just has never quite put it all together for a full season. But he shows flashes every single year, and that's what makes him so tantalizing. But, you know, like I wrote about this morning, and similarly with O'Neill, is that they've got three, if not four, starters locked down for next season. You know, do they want to add a lefty to the mix instead of Pivetta? Do they want to add more of a ground ball pitcher to the mix instead of Pivetta, who's a strikeout fly ball guy? It's one of those things where if it was team agnostic, I would say he'll probably get the QO. But again, just with the Red Sox situation, both payroll wise and positional fit wise, I would say like mildly surprised to see Pivetta get one. But I do think whoever signs him, especially if the ballpark is a better fit than Fenway, which most ballparks are, I think a lot of teams would be really happy to have him for a 3 or 4 year deal. And like I wrote about, I think it's similar to Kikuchi's free agent a few years ago. It's similar to, you know, even going back to like Tyler Chatwood with the Cubs, which did not work out well, but I think some team is going to just see all of the potential and feel that they can be the ones to unlock it.
Yeah. Kikuchi, by the way, who is not eligible for a qualifying offer because he got traded in season. And there's that rule to keep teams from trading for guys and being like, oh, well, worst case scenario, we get a qualifying offer for them. Jack Flaherty falls into that as well. And then a couple guys who have received it before. Last one for you on that. Shane Bieber, obviously like at the high end, like a Cy Young candidate guy, but through 12 innings this year and is going to be coming back from injury. If this were the Yankees or the Dodgers, I think it's probably safe that they still give him the qualifying offer and bet that, you know, hey, having him come back at 1 year, 20 million, 21 million, you know, given the track record is an okay enough bet. Too risky for a team like Cleveland?
Yeah, I mean, their team record payroll is, I think, not even 120 million. So you're looking at minimum like 1/6 of your payroll being taken up by a guy who is ace caliber when he's healthy and when the velocity is there. But, you know, when will he come back? I think like mid-April is one of the worst times to have Tommy John surgery because you have one setback and you basically end up missing two full seasons. We're seeing it with DeGrom, who got it about a month later and is basically going to end up missing two full seasons. So, I mean, that's a huge risk for Cleveland and just how they operate with, I think they want to have that, you know, Rays-esque sustained success that they largely have had and I think are really working towards. And, you know, does paying at best probably $1 million per start for Bieber, not knowing if his velocity is going to be the 89-90 that had him more of a mid-rotation guy or the 93-95 that he was this year and when he was unreal in 2020. I think that's a lot to risk for them, even though it's pretty clear that the thing that the Guardians are really missing is an ace-level starting pitcher, and Bieber certainly is that, but will he be next year? Who can say?
Yeah, and I mean, in these situations too, Bieber could just hit the market and see what's out there, but there's always the chance, hey, we're not going to give you the QO, but let's work something out. Let's work a multi-year deal out right away. You can do this with the arbitration stuff as well. The Jays have a couple tough decisions there with like a Jordan Romano coming off of injury. Okay, let's not risk it all 1 year. We'll cover some of your risk, but let us spread that out over a couple years here. So be interesting to see how that all plays out. John, thanks for taking the time out this morning. Keep up all the great work.
Of course, Blake. Thanks for having me.
John Becker of Fangraphs. Make sure you're checking that stuff out there. And a note from our pal at Fangraphs today, by the way. They did note this morning. I talked the other day about how valuable that subscription is and how you can customize all your player pages and download all the data really easily and things like that. Especially if you're a fantasy player, it's incredibly useful. They are going to a paywall system. Now, you'll still get 10 free articles a month, which is a good runway there. but think about supporting them. They do a ton of great work, and obviously we bring them on and use their work a lot on this show. Speaking of great work, colleague David Singh at Sportsnet, senior writer there, has been doing a lot of great work on the Jays the last couple years, including a terrific piece this week where he spoke to Francisco Lindor about his relationship with Blue Jays top prospect Arjun Amala. So Arjun Amala, for anyone who hasn't been watching the show or Blue Jays Central or whatever, Jays first round pick last year, 20th overall, started the season at Dunedin this year, really aggressive level because he was one of the youngest players in all of affiliated ball, struggled initially, goes to the developmental complex, figures it out, comes back to Dunedin and ends the season with the second best OPS in the entire league. Some of the best numbers in all of affiliated baseball for anyone 18 or younger. So really exciting time there. And then really exciting to hear a guy like Francisco Lindor say, yeah, that guy's going to be a star. David Singh, senior writer at Sportsnet, joins us now to talk about it. David, how are you this morning?
Blake, I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing well, man. Great story. First of all, how uncertain were you that a star the level of Francisco Lindor, a guy who has big media demands on him all the time in New York and is maybe headed for an MVP here, is willing to take out the time to chat with you at length about an 18-year-old prospect in another team's A-ball league?
And I know, right? Great question. I think the thing is you can always tell by a player's initial reaction. I mean, I learned a long time ago, when you want to talk to an opposing player who you don't know, you just tell them right off the bat, okay, do you have a second to talk about X? And as soon as I mention Arjun's name, do you have a second to talk about Arjun? Francisco Lindor's eyes lit up. So at that moment, I knew, okay, this is going to be a good day for me.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's a great way to broach it, and then a good sign. And I think tells us something about Francisco Lindor as a person that he's willing to do that. So tell us a little bit about it. For anyone who's listening and didn't get a chance to read the article yet, what is the relationship like between Lindor and Amala?
Yeah, so they're represented by the same agency, and they've trained together in the past two off seasons. So I did a feature on Arjun last year, and one of the first things he told me was that he absolutely loves Francisco Lindor. He's always been his favorite player. Arjun used the word swagger. That's his word, not mine. But he just loves the way Lindor carries himself, and Arjun has always embodied, you know, he's tried to embody that. And so they've trained together, they keep in touch, and Lindor's actually been quite helpful to Arjun over the years. I mean, tips, they stay in touch, you know, footwork, little things in Arjun's game he's tried to take from Lindor, and he's also, you know, leaned on Lindor as well. And Lindor, for his part, really likes Arjun. I mean, he loves his tools, he loves his makeup, he loves just the way he carries himself. And he, you know, in the article, he used the word face of the franchise. So, I mean, that's as high a praise as you can get from anybody, especially someone who, you know, as important as Lindor is to this season of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and a guy who knows a little something about sticking at shortstop as a power hitter. Now, Lindor is 5'11", charitably listed. I think I was eye to eye with him the other day, whereas Arjun's, you know, 6'1", and is gonna fill out in a way that, who knows, maybe he has to move to third or something like that eventually. But yeah, Lindor knows something about being a power hitting shortstop. So for you, how fun has this, like, I know you've kept like a reasonably close eye on Amala because you've written those stories about him in the past and had this one coming up. How excited are you, you know, from a Blue Jays perspective that he's had the season that he's had at just 18 down at A-ball?
It's amazing. Like, I'm, you know, pretty happy about it. I think the thing is, and even tying in Kumar Rocker from last night, mm-hmm. right? Like, becoming the first player of Indian descent to play in the big leagues. I think it's one thing to, like, basically, you know, make a big deal about it and enjoy it before it happens, right? When Arjun gets drafted or when Kumar Rocker gets drafted and they're on the way up. But now that the fact that they're actually good, like Arjun, like you just mentioned his stats, you know, what he did to end off the season. And with Kumar, the start last night, to see these guys actually excelling, I think to me that's the more important part. That's the part that makes me more happy is, okay, now we have a seat at the table. Now people of South Asian descent have a seat at the table in baseball, but they're actually doing good, right? It would be a lot different if Arjun, you know, continued his struggles earlier in the season. It would feel a lot different. If Kumar Rocker comes up last night and gets, you know, for lack of a better word, rocked, right? Like, it would, things would feel a little bit different. But the fact that these guys are actually excelling, I think that's what makes me happy. Because then eventually we can move past the conversation of, okay, now, you know, Indians can play baseball, to actually, okay, now it's just these guys are good baseball players. And I think we'll get there eventually.
Yeah, it could very much, you know, the way you described that reminded me of where we were 15, 20 years ago with Canadian basketball players in the NBA, where it was a novelty and then, oh, Steve Nash comes along and then there's like 20, before you know it, there's 20 guys and you forget that, oh yeah, that guy's Canadian too. We could be headed toward that. And I know this is important to you, David. I know it's something, I believe your first piece at Sportsnet was about this, like back in the day, right? Like the lack of South Asian representation in Major League Baseball.
For sure, yeah. That was my first big read at Sportsnet was in 2016, and it had been something on my mind a lot because, you know, what I wrote in the story, and I'll share a little bit with you now, is for me, my backstory is, you know, I grew up in the early 90s, right? And obviously there were no players of South Asian descent then in baseball. So I basically would gravitate to the Latin players. Robbie Alomar was my favorite when I was a kid because I kind of looked like him, but I saw myself looking like him, just at least with the skin color, the curly hair, things like that. So, you know, Jorge Posada, Juan Gonzalez, like these guys I really, really, really gravitated to for that reason. And, you know, that's my story. And I kind of weave that into a feature and looked at, okay, well, why is this happening? Why? You know, at that point, I was a grown man when I wrote the feature. It's like, okay, well, nothing's changed since I was a kid. What's up? And I spoke to Farhan Zaidi, who is president of baseball ops with the Giants, but back then he was with the Dodgers. And his opinion on that was that people from South Asian communities just don't value sports in the same way that others do, right? Like, they basically will grow up thinking, okay, there's only a couple careers you can take. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, you can be an engineer, and that's it. If you're not any of those things, then you're not good enough. And slowly that mentality has started to change as, you know, immigrants have come in and built up, you know, their lives. And now second generation Canadians of Indian descent are having kids. And, you know, there's more of a value on athletics and there's more of a an understanding of what athletics, what sport can do for youth. And so it's exciting to see. I mean, it's a shame that it took this long, but at least we're here, right? And I think that feature, looking back on it now, you know, almost 8 years later, it's kind of cool to see.
Yeah, it's very cool to see. I mean, it's cool to see for me. I imagine it's very, very cool to see for you. And then obviously there are, you know, we've talked about on this show before some of the cricket crossovers, and Arjun grew up playing some cricket as well. Have you spoken to Arjun about like what that element means to him? Like, is he carrying that with him, that level of, hey, I'm representing and I'm one of the first who's going to try to do this at the major league level? Or is that kind of, hey, he's an 18-year-old, let him focus on baseball?
No, so actually, it's great you asked that, because when I sat down with him last year, that was what impressed me the most about him, is that this kid is 18 years old and he really understands the gravity of what he represents. He understands, he used the word responsibility. I didn't use that. I didn't ask him a question with that word. He brought that word up himself. And I think that's what it is. He understands the responsibility. I mean, worldwide, he's already had people reaching out to him from India, from, you know, South Asian communities in Toronto, in Vancouver, all across Canada. He's dealt with this in America as well, even before he was drafted. So he has a keen understanding. And I think that he equated that to his parents. He kind of said that his parents raised him in a way to understand and I guess take pride in, you know, who he is. And so that's something that's special to him. And for an 18-year-old to say that, that's great. I can only imagine as he gets older and, you know, more experienced, wiser, he'll have more eloquent things to say on that. And I'm actually looking forward to seeing how he grows, not only on the baseball field, but from a maturity standpoint in terms of how he interacts with the media and how he kind of appreciates that. Because Toronto, as you know, has a huge South Asian population. And, you know, if he eventually gets here, things will, the spotlight will really, really, really be on him. So I'm kind of interested to see how he handles that as well.
Yeah, and responsibility is a great word for it, and opportunity, honestly. If he's good and you can be, you know, a representative of that community and tap into that community as a ball player here, could be a lot of fun. David, before I let you go, so your background is doing the big reads. That's how I know your work. But obviously the last 2 years you've been around the Blue Jays kind of every day. We don't do the big reads as much at Sportsnet. You're doing more game coverage and stuff like that. How have you found this season as someone who, yes, is doing game coverage, you know, write a nice piece on Nathan Lucas getting called up and returning to the team in Minnesota, but you're like, you're a guy who looks for the story that maybe the rest of us aren't telling. In a season like this, how have you found that? Have you found there are even more of those stories because there's been so much turnover and things like that? Like, are you having fun with that aspect of what is a disappointing year otherwise?
Yeah, I think the act of being at the ballpark every single day naturally makes, you know, makes it easier. I think that there, as a feature writer, you kind of parachute in and you don't have really a sense of the dynamics of the team, the personalities. You kind of just jump in, you do the story and you get out, right? Being a beat writer now and being there every single day, you're privy to just a deeper understanding of the team. And the example I would point to was a story I'm pretty proud of, is the story of George Springer being the clubhouse DJ. And that came about because I was just randomly in the clubhouse on like a Saturday morning, just doing the regular job, waiting to speak to John Schneider. And I was hanging out in the clubhouse. And, you know, this great scene unfolded in front of me where George Springer started playing Celine Dion and teasing some of the younger guys that, oh, you know, you weren't even born when this came out, from the Titanic soundtrack. I forget the name of the song. But anyways, stuff like that. It's been a joy to kind of be around more and just take in all of that and understand the context behind it. So I'm really enjoying myself, to answer your question.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. I'm enjoying the work and glad you got to check out places like Fenway and, to a lesser extent, you know, Minnesota. I haven't been to the new ballpark in Minnesota, but I like it as a city. Yeah, glad you're enjoying it, man. Thank you for taking the time out this morning. Really appreciate it.
Oh, man, Blake, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
David Singh, senior writer at Sportsnet. Make sure you're checking out all his great work. But again, it's a terrific piece up at sportsnet.ca talking to Francisco Lindor about one of the Blue Jays' top and most interesting prospects, Arjun Namala. Might talk about Arjun Namala a little bit more next week. We'll see how the guest thing shakes out. That's all I'll say about that for now. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Esteban Ribera about the New York Yankees, about Matt Chapman suddenly becoming a speed demon on the base paths. We'll talk about the National League Rookie of the Year race and a bunch more. Then we'll talk to Katie Wu of The Athletic, get to know this Cardinals team that's here for a three set starting tonight down at Rogers Center at 7:07. Grateful Dead night. The hat's not going to look good on me. It's not going to fit well, but I would like one to have just sitting out regardless. Someone help me out on the Blue Jays side. Let's take a break. We'll talk to Esteban and Katie when we come back as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Stock Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Little Frank Ocean playing us back, and I always send our producer and board ops today. It's Austin Mackey and Jake Schultz. The exact timestamp that I want a song, just in case there's like swearing or it's something specific. And I almost didn't for that song. I completely forgot what the opening lyrics to that song are, and they are not profane, but they are wild, and I'm glad I remembered to double check. Anyway, also wild, the Yankees winning back-to-back games in walk-off fashion. They are atop the American League East. They got a two-game lead on the Orioles now. They got to be feeling okay, Clay Holmes aside. Let's talk to Esteban Rivera of Fangraphs, of Pinstripe Alley, and now of the NBA about it. Esteban, good morning. How we doing?
Hey, what's up, Blake? How are you?
Good, man. Back-to-back walk-offs. I know that anytime there's a walk-off, it means like you didn't execute earlier, and in this case, particularly Clay Holmes, one of those nights. But how you feeling Yankees-wise right now?
I feel like since the rule has come on, they've lost so many games via walk-off fashion in extra innings. So it's nice to get two in a row, even if they're on little dinky ground balls through the left side. Although I don't know if it's fair to call Juan Soto anything he hits dinky, but Feels nice.
Yeah, in relative terms, it was dinky for Juan Soto, which probably means it was like 110 miles an hour or something like that. Okay, so the bullpen side of this, though, obviously great that they came through in those two, that they have the two-game cushion now against the Orioles, who lost a walk-off of their own against that Red Sox team two nights prior. Just Keegan Aiken just grooving one to Tyler O'Neill. What are you doing, man? Anyway, the Yankees, there's been some angst, it seems, from afar around that bullpen, and particularly Clay Holmes at the back of it. He had blown Wednesday's game, but then locked down yesterday's game and got the win. What do you make of Clay Holmes' performance on the season? I think we're up to 12 blown saves now. Some uncertainty about how the back end of that bullpen is going to shake out in the postseason.
So, I mean, I have thoughts on Clay Holmes in general. I think that any pitcher or any reliever, especially, that's relying on a singular outlier pitch year over year, it can be a little suspect, because a tiny mechanical flaw or difference can lead to a change in that pitch quality. And we've seen that with the sinker in the last year, even though he's been pretty unlucky when it comes to the timing of stringing singles together. I think that it can just be tough relying on such an outlier pitch like Clay Holmes. He's got one of those pitches that has a really sharp entry horizontally into the zone. And in order to execute that over and over again, your mechanics, your proprioception, so the way you're feeling the ball in your hands needs to just hold year over year. So I think generally speaking, it's hard to rely on a guy like that to be nails every single time out, even within a month, within a week, over the course of a season.
Well, first of all, you're using the term proprioception. This is how I know you're doing more NBA stuff now. That's like the nerd scouting side of basketball Twitter. Proprioception is like a favorite. You watch the like nerdier YouTube breakdowns on a prospect, that word is bound to come up. This is how I know you're doing some basketball stuff now. But yeah, it's interesting when you're a one-pitch guy. Like Eric Swanson is maybe a good comp for the Blue Jays this year, where the splitter actually, like, by metric-wise, hasn't been terrible, but when you are primarily a splitter guy and you lose the feel for it or lose the location, your margin for error is just so thin. So with respect to how they're going to use Holmes from here, how they're going to adjust to that, Cousins has been pretty good, Canley's been pretty good, Tim Hill's been pretty good. I know Weaver had been, but less so lately. What do you make of how they handle this the rest of the way? Like, it's funny because I would want a manager to manage situationally and matchup-wise and leverage-wise and things like that. And it almost feels like Boone has a free pass to not manage by the closer role now because Clay Holmes hasn't been that effective. How do you see that playing out?
I think it's a smart move. And I think in the last 5-6 years now that it's been since Aaron Boone has been the manager, he's done better without a closer, a traditional closer, and just flexing on those matchups and trying. One word he used to say all the time is using lanes to determine what reliever he's going to go to. I feel like he's gotten a little bit away from that since Clay Holmes has taken the closer job almost by default in the last year or so. But I'm okay with them trying to get back to picking lanes and having two pitchers in particular, and Tommy Canley and Luke Weaver, who have almost platoon-less profiles because of their changeups and their movement of their changeups. It allows you a little bit more flexibility. It doesn't mean that I'm confident in the bullpen. I don't know if I have been all year. I think I wrote an article in the beginning of the season that was titled, "Is the Yankees bullpen mid?" And I think that that's still a question that I have in my head. So, but whose bullpen is nails going to the postseason?
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, the Orioles are dealing with the same thing, right? Both of those teams, I think, are ranked around like the 15 to 20 range in bullpen ERA since the trade deadline, which begs the question, like, should they have done more than Mark Leiter Jr. and Tim Mayza off the Toronto Blue Jays scrap heap to address the bullpen? But this is where we are. So you're going to have to get it done with some offense. To help with that, they called up Jason Dominguez. We've gotten a couple games of it now. What are you looking for from Dominguez? Like, where are, obviously he is a prospect who has all the tools and potential in the world longer term. What are you looking for from him shorter term, rest of the way here?
Well, I don't think he's going to get much burn against lefties because his right-handed swing looks a little rough right now. It's just like a little tightly wound. But in terms of my expectations, I'm expecting him to be able to produce power against right-handed pitchers. I think that that's his skill. He's able to pull pitches all around the zone. And if he can just continue on doing that, they don't need superstar production from him. They just need competent offense and competent defense. And if that's what he's going to give for the next month and into the postseason, I'm happy with it. Maybe going forward, that's not the case. I would have higher expectations for his like star offense development. But for now, I'm just looking for competence. And I think the team should be too.
In terms of what this Yankees lineup looks like and how it is to pitch against, obviously it has Soto and Judge, right? Like that's the headline item. That's what everyone's preparing for. But you compare it today to where it was at the start of the season, and it strikes me that they have, even though Stanton and Anthony Rizzo are still in there most days and things like that, a lot more speed. They added Jazz Chisholm, who's stolen 35 bases. Anthony Volpe, when he can get on base, can steal base. And now you add Jason Dominguez's speed as well. It's obviously, it's a little hard to change your identity like that on the fly, but do you like that the Yankees are maybe a little bit more versatile around Soto and Judge now, if they're, even if they're, the lineup still isn't, you know, all that great in support of them?
Yeah, I think the one thing that comes to lineup, just structuring a lineup or structuring a roster, is I like having variance between my players, whether that be variance in offensive profile, variance in base running aggression. And I think it always gives a different look to the pitcher, to the catcher, if they're worrying about a guy needing to steal second, steal third. They have to be aggressive more with their blocks, if the runner is willing to go on a dirt ball read, all those kinds of things. So the more variance and versatility you can create in the lineup, I think the better, just to give pitchers and catchers a different look.
Yeah, the pitchers and catchers part of that is an important one. If you're headed for a World Series against the Arizona Diamondbacks, you're going to want to have that element if Gabriel Moreno is not back. Okay, so you mentioned longer term, you have, you know, maybe higher hopes for Jason Dominguez's upside. What does, in your eyes, what does that outfield look like next year? Like, is Dominguez in center with Judge given a try in left field, or did they leave Judge in center field, even though he's the largest center fielder to ever play there and he's into his 30s now? This is, of course, under the assumption that Juan Soto is back. If he is not, then we could throw all this out.
I'm fine with that assumption. Okay. Let's hold that one. The interesting thing about, I think, Yankees history in the last like 10 years, and really when Brett Gardner was on the roster, is that there's so much surface area. And again, going pretty nerdy here, there's a lot of surface area to cover in left center field in Yankee Stadium. So from an alignment perspective, I think it's okay to have a stronger outfielder in left field than it is in right. Because really going towards right center, there's not that much ground to cover, especially depending on how you align the right fielder. So leaving Jason in left field is okay. Would I do that? Probably not, only because I think we've seen pretty clearly the regression of Judge in the outfield. And I think that regression might even hold going to the corners too. So my grounded take is that Jason and Judge sort of switched between center and left next year. And my steaming take is that Judge should probably move out of the outfield pretty soon if the Yankees' priority is keeping his offense at, dare I say, Bonzian level, just preserving his health and making sure his offense is the priority.
Yeah, and Anthony Rizzo, you know, club option for next year and 22, you know, even if they pick that up, 2026, he's out of there. So Stanton is under contract until like 2217 still, but otherwise there will be opportunities to move. And yeah, I'm going to guess that 50, 55, 60 home runs still plays fine at first base. And he has the athleticism there. On the Soto front, what has the experience been like this year where it's such an NBA-style situation where they've traded for a guy, some of the prospects have already turned out, like a Michael King. Soto is having an all-time year, like one of the best offensive years you could possibly hope for, and the Yankees are competitive. So you could, you know, if you are a good compartmentalizer, you could very much just focus on 2024 here and appreciate what's going on and love Juan Soto. But if you are not a compartmentalizer, you're an anxious person, or you are just this type, you're thinking always about the free agency. How has that been to navigate that?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I think that most Yankee fans fall into the bucket of anxious about his prospects going forward. Without Juan Soto, this Yankees team is not very good, probably. So just in terms of what the next option would be and what the lineup looks like, it would be pretty bleak, especially with the O's and even the Red Sox, to be honest, with high hopes for next season and the next 2 to 3 years. But at the same time, I think the one thing that stuck out to me, especially when I've been in the stadium, is one, the connection that like Soto is willing to bring to like interacting with fans. And the one thing that I'll always go back to is like on the first game in Yankee Stadium where he made his home debut, he's running out to right field and someone drapes a big Dominican flag like over the right field wall, as big as the WB Mason like advertisement out there in right field. And yeah, there's other places where there's, you know, strong Latin or Dominican populations, but I don't know if that's happening in any other stadium. And that kind of thing means a lot to not only Juan Soto, but just other Dominican and Latin players in general. So I hope that that means a lot, and that it means as much as the financial gap might be between the Yankees and maybe the Mets.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the Mets play pretty close by in a city that also has a good Dominican population. So I don't know. You could play that card against like the Seattle Mariners. I don't know if you could play that card against the team that plays right down the road from you. Okay, want to pivot off the Yankees for the last minute or two here. You tweeted about this the other day. Matt Chapman has 15 stolen bases this year. He has never stolen more than 4 bases in a season before. I know base running as a skill is something you've written about at FanGraphs before. What do you make of that? This is like 31 years old, very large Matt Chapman, suddenly a speed demon.
Yeah, you're catching me at a good time because I've been doing the research to write something up on this. Last year, I think around this time of year, maybe right after the season, I wrote a similar article about Freddie Freeman because he stole over 20 bases last year. And the way that I like to think about it is, all right, you got a guy who's like, you know, pretty fast, but he doesn't have blazing speed. It's not what he's known for. So in that position, like what's required to have the confidence to take off that many times when you've barely taken off that much in your entire career and you're like a 30-year-old veteran? And what are the circumstances needed to know when it's time to go? So it's knowing catcher pop time, knowing how long it takes for a guy to deliver home, having a good expectation of what pitch they're going to deliver and what they're where they usually throw those pitch types. So it's telling for a veteran like him to take this and sort of flexing their base running IQ or just their baseball IQ in general, because he's taking off at the right times and he has a really good understanding of when he needs to go. And like that is just, it's a flex, honestly. I think it's a big flex to be like, you know what? I'm smart enough to know that I can make it even though I'm not one of the fastest guys out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Freddie Freeman only got thrown out one time all last year. Matt Chapman's only been thrown out twice this year. Here in Toronto, I mean, George Springer always had a little bit of speed, but he set a career high on stolen bases last year, and he's 14 for 15 this year at age 34. So it's interesting. Like, stolen bases, obviously speed helps, but there is a big, can you anticipate, can you think the pitcher and the catcher and things like that? Can you pick your spots? Although I always a little bit, and maybe this doesn't apply to Chapman and Freeman types. This applies to, like, there was a year Bo Bichette was like 24 for 25 stealing bases. And my opinion is, if you are successful like more than 90% of the time, you're not trying enough. You got to push the envelope on that more. Probably doesn't apply to Matt Chapman. Applies to most guys if they were, 15 for 16, 15 for 17 stealing bases.
Yeah, and I think the math supports that on like a league-wide scale going into at least after last year.
Okay, before I let you go here, why do you care so much about New Balance athletes? You are as locked in on New Balance baseball athletes as we in Toronto were when Kawhi Leonard was here as the New Balance guy.
That is a good question. Well, I think I'm interested in sneakers and, you know, sports fashion in general, like street fashion. And I'm also interested in baseball. So the intersection of those two things is like pretty fascinating to me. And I don't know if it's a New Balance thing or just that New Balance is on the come up and they happen to be the group on the come up. And they've snagged an athlete in Francisco Lindor who is really into fashion. And then also Shohei Ohtani. He's pretty famous. So I think it's more about they have gained so much popularity in like street fashion in the US and Japan in the last, I don't know, you can say decade, depending on where we're talking about. And baseball has fallen off in popularity in terms of their athletes and affecting street culture like they used to when A-Rod and Jeter and Griffey were at the peak of the game. So I've sort of been curious as to where's the avenue for that to become what it was 20 years ago, if there is an avenue. And I think it's through the New Balance guys because of the timing of it all. And I've written about it a little bit. I want to more, but I think that's pretty much why I'm into it. And then Francisco Lindor is one of my favorite guys to watch, and it's nice watching Ohtani too. So
yeah, those two guys at the high end is pretty good. It's not quite the days of, you know, when Matt Bonner was the New Balance athlete or whatever. You know, it's cool. All right, Esteban, thanks a lot. I know I can't ask you about your NBA stuff, even though I have a million questions about your player health and analytics role there. So I'll let you go, man. Hope you're
thanks, Blake.
As much as it hurts, hope your Yankees have a good rest of the season, buddy.
Thanks. We'll see. Appreciate you having me.
Esteban Rivera of Pinstripe Alley of FanGraphs, and yeah, does some non-public work on the NBA player health and analytics side, which I would love to pick his brain on more off the air because he is probably not allowed to talk about it on the air. One more note on FanGraphs, great piece up from Michael Bauman, our pal who comes on sometimes today, about Leo Jimenez. So I had mentioned a couple times on the show lately just how crazy it is that Leo Jimenez has been hit by so many pitches. Michael broke that down. On pitches that miss inside, Leo Jimenez has been hit by almost 10% of them. The league average is 1.7%. So about 2% of pitches on the inside part of the plate will hit someone. Leo Jimenez is up around 10%. Nobody else is over 7%. Pretty ridiculous. Leo Jimenez, a magnet for the ball. And yeah, 28 hit by pitch between AAA and the majors this year. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's get to know this Cardinals team. We'll talk to Katie Wu of The Athletic and set up this series that starts tonight for Grateful Dead Night down at Rogers Center, 7:07. Eric Fetty against, we think, Kevin Gausman, but not confirmed yet. Katie Wu joins us after the break to break it all down.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy, Jays back in action, 7:07 tonight against a Cardinals team that similarly thought they'd be playing more important baseball right now. The Cardinals are a little better than the Blue Jays, two games over 500, but they remain six games out of a playoff spot. It's all but done for them as they start to turn the focus to 2025, including calling up Thomas DeJacy, one of their top prospects the other day. Let's talk to Katie Wu about it of The Athletic. Katie, good morning. How are you doing?
Blake, good morning. Nice to hear from you. How are you?
I am wonderful. Looks like you've got a terrific hotel or Airbnb there as well. Welcome to Toronto. What, do you have anything planned other than the baseball for the weekend?
I do not. A dinner on Saturday because okay. We just realized that Saturday was kind of a day game. So I'm pretty excited. Never been to Toronto before. This was definitely on my list of cities and road trips. I just thought, much like you, that this would be a much more compelling series in the middle of September than it's actually turning out to be.
Well, welcome, first of all. And I hope that it being a less compelling series does free you up to enjoy the city a little bit more, at least since, you know, you probably don't need to. We can skim it back from like 1,800 words, like 1,200 words this time of season. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
How have the Cardinals ended up here? Obviously, we know how the Jays have ended up here, but, you know, a little underwhelming relative to expectations this year for the Cardinals. What's happened?
Yeah, it's a good question, because coming into the 2024 season, the hype was all about the Cardinals pitching, how they needed to revamp their rotation and shore up their bullpen. And they actually did that. The pitching's been fine this year. Those veterans guys, Sonny Gray, Kyle Gibson, Lance Lynn has been hurt, but he's back now. They've done exactly what they were signed to do. And the Cardinals bullpen has been one of the best in baseball. I mean, Ryan Helsley, 44 saves, and the Cardinals have not had like a ton of save opportunities. So it's even more impressive. It's been the offense. You've had underwhelming seasons from Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado. Wilson Contreras two separate injuries. His season is all but done after suffering a fractured finger against the Twins in August. And then you look at the secondary talent that was supposed to supplement Arenado and Goldschmidt. You're thinking Jordan Walker spent most of the year in the minors. Nolan Gorman, where is he? He's currently in AAA. And it just seems that there was a total drop-off in terms of offensive production. So that's kind of where the Cardinals got where they are now. They certainly were not expecting to have this lackluster of an offensive performance. They were so focused about pitching, but baseball's a funny game, Blake, and they found themselves really caught off guard with their lack of offense this year.
Yeah, funny and cruel. It's, you know, Paul Goldschmidt is 37, and we kind of all assumed that he would just be Paul Goldschmidt forever. He's, quote-unquote, now just a league average bat, but that's such a dramatic change from where we thought he'd be. So I do want to dig in on some of those specifics in a little bit here, but you wrote the other day that, okay, now the Cardinals are looking to jumpstart 2025. They're not trying to tank these games. They'd still like to win, but the focus is on 2025. What does that look like over the next couple of weeks for them?
You're going to see them, I like to say, semi-shift to 2025. The Cardinals are still playing for something. They'll tell you they're not mathematically eliminated, but, you know, the writing is on the wall. They're in that wild card. But one thing that is very important to this organization is that the Cardinals have never posted back-to-back losing seasons since 162-game seasons were implemented in Major League Baseball. That is a stat they would really like to keep, especially given how disastrous 2023 was for them. But there is still a way to figure out what their young talent, or some of their young talent at least, looks like going into 25. So Jordan Walker is back up after, again, spending most of the season in the minors. He's going to play every day in right field, regardless of what that looks like, because the Cardinals need to see what they can expect going into next year from him. Thomas DeJacy, their most recent call-up, he's going to play around the diamond. He can play shortstop, second, and third base. The Cardinals want to see what that looks like at the major league level. St. Louis, as you probably know, has an affinity for utility Swiss Army knife players. So seeing what Thomas DeJacy has maybe frees up what they can do with Brendan Donovan or something like that. You're going to see more, maybe more of the younger guys in the rotation. Andre Pallante has been pretty good for them, arguably their best starter in the second half. He might get one more start. The Cardinals rotation is still in flux. All we know is that Eric Fetty will start today. Everything else is to be determined, but you can see little ways for the Cardinals to shift towards next year. That's not even talking about their catchers and Pedro Páez and Ivan Herrera, two rookies that have had to fill in for Wilson Contreras' absence. All around, there is a way to still post relatively competitive games, but focus on 2025 as well, and that's how I think you'll see the Cardinals end this regular season.
You mentioned the probable pitchers for this series. This is how you know it's mid-September and it's not particularly important baseball. So there's one pitcher listed across the two teams for this series. Get ready for some bullpen days or weird, I don't know, something odd will go down for sure. Okay, so a couple of the names in there are pretty interesting. I know you just had a big feature go up on Thomas DeJacy getting the call. So number four prospect in the Cardinals organization per Keith Law strikes me as very Cardinals-y, like multi-position guy, was only a fifth-round pick. No, like, one elite skill, but does a little bit of everything. The word grit comes up, like, 50 times per Sejacy conversation on the broadcasts. What can you tell us about, we don't know him yet at the major league level, but for a Jays fan who maybe doesn't know the prospect book on him or what to expect here?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. Thomas Sejacy definitely profiles as a Cardinal. One thing to know about him, is that he didn't come up through the Cardinals system. He was part of one of the trades at the Cardinals deadline last year. So he's a little bit different in terms of player development. And maybe that's why he was able to ascend through the system a little bit more quickly. The Rangers were very high on him. This is, of course, who the Cardinals got for Jordan Montgomery. And there's good reason. He does a lot of things right. He's a ball player, is what Ollie Marmol said. And that's what you want to hear if you're a prospect coming up through the system. Again, we just talked about it. The Cardinals like those Swiss Army knife kind of guys. So JC is one of them. He can hit for power, though he's more like what you're seeing now. The guy that can just has a good bat to ball skills, makes a lot of contact, has a good amount of range. He's just, again, like Ollie Marmol said, a ball player. So we'll see a little bit more of him. We will see him in the lineup almost every day. Just the position will change. Mason Wynn and Alec Burleson, they're at their career highs in innings played. They're going through it. Brendan Donovan's had a sore foot for the last week. So bringing Sejacy up was, yes, a little bit to see what he could do at the major league level, but also just to give these Cardinals infielders a break.
So given Sejacy is, quick through the minors here and still only 22, not a lock that he'll be in the mix for next year. But let's say he looks good and the Cardinals get comfortable with him. You mentioned the Brendan Donovan impact. Would this have an impact on, you know, Nolan Gorman's future? As well, you mentioned he's back down in AAA. I know he's still just 24 and there's a ton of power in that bat. But it seems like maybe this year has, not gone particularly well as far as, hey, Nolan Gorman's a core piece of the future next to Mason Wynn.
Yeah, they were certainly planning for that. And when you're a prospect or a player at this point like Nolan Gorman, and you have such prodigious power, the strikeouts are going to be a part of that. That's just part of the game. You can't really have a power bat and not have a good amount of strikeout or swing and miss. But it got to the point where it was just too much. Gorman had a strikeout rate just below 40%. It was the fourth highest in all of baseball. And at this point, it wasn't fair to both the Cardinals and to Gorman to roll him out every day when he was so clearly lost for such a long time. He stayed up with the Cardinals for about 3 months while struggling through the slump. But it was because the Cardinals didn't really have any options in the minor leagues that would allow them to alleviate Gorman and send him back to Memphis where he could fix his swing. So JAC is finally deemed ready. So I do think it will be an interesting competition going into spring training. Again, so JC isn't a true second baseman. Honestly, neither is Nolan Gorman, but they're playing him there anyway. And we'll see what the Cardinals could do. I think when you're looking to 2025, a lot of decisions need to be made over the offseason. The obvious, of course, is if they're going to bring back Paul Goldschmidt or not. But there are a bunch of young, talented players who kind of all do the same thing for the Cardinals and make the roster a little bit redundant. And I'm interested to see how the front office approaches that. I certainly think Gorman is one of those players to consider.
Yeah, it seems kind of similar to the spot the Jays are in, where they have a bunch of fairly interesting young pieces getting opportunities now, but they can't all be on the roster next year. It's like that's the makeup of a really good bench. But if those guys are also starting four spots in the lineup, you're probably in trouble. And weirdly, like the Cardinals, the Jays are also like abnormally lefty heavy. Like they're the only two teams in the history of baseball who are like, we have too many lefties. We have too many lefties. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. You mentioned the high strikeout rate. That's something that has plagued Jordan Walker and was part of why he was back down in the minors. I know he's been back up for a couple weeks now playing every day. Has it gone any better at all for Jordan Walker? I know he had that big five-hit game a while back, but the surface-level stats don't look all that fun.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when you think of Jordan Walker and how he progressed through his minor league career, he was never really a guy that struck out a lot. But the book is out on Jordan Walker. These major league pitchers know what his weakness is, and it's the slider low and away. He's had a really hard time laying off that pitch. And, you know, I think you can make the argument that Jordan Walker wasn't necessarily set up for the success when he debuted. You know, they switched him from the Cardinals being they switched him from third base to the outfield, and he played there for just 4 months professionally before he was expected to do so at the major league level. You combine that with the struggles that are going to happen offensively. Everyone needs to adjust a little bit and go through slumps when they come to the major leagues. And he just really has not been able to figure it out. It's gotten incrementally better, but still a ways to go. If the Cardinals are expecting Jordan Walker to have that impact that they thought he would over the last 2 years, some of it's on the organization, some of it's on Jordan to make those adjustments. And that's why you're seeing him get such an extensive some run here, because one, like we talked about, they are starting to look to 25. But if they are going to have Jordan Walker penned in the lineup like they did coming into this year, they need to know what that production is going to be, and they need to know if it's capable of matching up their expectations.
Yeah, and it's I'd imagine it is also at least a little Goldschmidt related. Not that he's going to move to first base necessarily, but how that lineup shakes out. Do you have a power bat in the middle of that order? Yeah, it's. I feel like I'm asking all these questions about guys who are just like 22, 23, 24. But the Cardinals are so interestingly built with Goldschmidt and Arenado at the high end, and then everyone else being, pretty unproven so far. Last one on guys that fit that description. I know you just had a great feature on Victor Scott and the work that the Cardinals were trying to do to get more out of him. Obviously a guy who, when he gets on base, is a monster stolen base threat. Just hasn't been able to do that at the major league level. What are the Cardinals trying to accomplish with him back down in AAA to get him ready for a potential role next year?
So the Cardinals got a little bit of a break when they just happened to stumble upon Michael Cianni on waivers last year. And when the Cardinals entered spring training, there were a bunch of different outfielders ahead of both Cianni and Scott on their depth chart. You're thinking Tommy Edman, no longer with the organization, Dylan Carlson, same situation. Lars Nootbaar, who profiles much better as a corner outfielder than a center fielder. With Victor Scott, who, because of his elite skill set and basically his speed, he was always kind of penciled in to be the center fielder of the future. But Cianni is the more developed all-around center fielder at this point. What the Cardinals would like to see from Victor Scott is he has the speed to make up for any play, really. I mean, he's probably one of the fastest players in Major League Baseball when he is here. What I like to see improvements defensively is his first step quickness and his route efficiency, because the metrics are suggesting that he's actually below league average in both of these things. He just has the speed to overcome an initial bad read or an initial bad route. So they'd like to see him get better on those sides of the play so that he doesn't have to rely on his speed to get to the ball. One thing they really like about Ciani is his first step quickness is one of the top in the sport. So the next thing in Victor Scott's progression, his development, is to be better in those two elements. That way he's not relying on just his speed to make sure he gets to the ball. He's actually giving himself the best chance to field the ball each time. And they have some time to get this right with Victor Scott, unlike they did with, you know, go down the list of many of their prospects because of Ciani's emergence. So while fans are rightfully excited for Victor Scott's future, this isn't a rush him up and get him here now like it was in March when they didn't have an outfielder. It's a, hey, we know the where he needs to improve. Let's send him back to the minor so he can do it in a less pressure environment. And then maybe come spring training next year, there's a new competition for center field. But right now, it's just all about the next step in his development. It doesn't mean the Cardinals have soured on him or he's not high on their radar. It just means they have time with this position to actually let him develop in the place where he needs to be.
And the nice thing team building wise is all of these guys that we've talked about are young. They all have options next year. They're all pre-arb or like very, very cheap still. So even if the Cardinals, you know, this will turn from a weakness to a strength quickly if one or two of these guys click and suddenly you have good prospect depth at AAA, add a guy to the major league roster, everyone slides down a slot. You mentioned earlier the big question for the position player side of their offseason will be what happens with Paul Goldschmidt, 37 now at the end of this five-year contract and six-year run with the Cardinals. Do you have a sense of where that relationship is or where Paul Goldschmidt's, you know, plans might be beyond the season?
I do think Goldschmidt would like to play at least one more year. And, you know, I certainly think he enjoys being a Cardinal. His family lives down in Jupiter where the spring training complex is for the team. And when you think of the Cardinals, I mean, I think Goldschmidt's just been a staple for this organization for so long. It's difficult to imagine the Cardinals without him, but there are some difficult decisions to be made. They'll almost certainly let Goldschmidt go to free agency just because I highly doubt that they would re-sign him at his current contract status. I think if the Cardinals do explore a deal with Goldschmidt, it's much more team friendly, and maybe it's has some incentives built in. We'll see. But the Cardinals they've been historically pretty solid about waiting until the season ends for their big extensions and their big decisions. I would imagine that stays the same for Goldschmidt, but we'll see. I think right now it's pretty up in the air on what that future looks like. You also have to consider their young talent, like we talked about. Blake, Alec Burleson can play first base. That's probably his best defensive position. Credit him for trying the outfield and sticking with it, but I don't necessarily think he's an outfielder. Jordan Walker, like we talked about, you know, what could they do with Nolan Gorman? All this young, controllable talent, and they're all kind of playing out of position. But what Goldschmidt brings to the team, it's invaluable. So we will see. It's, for me, it's question number one of the offseason of what they're going to do.
Okay, so we're going to see Eric Fetty tonight. He's the only starter we know for sure, although if everyone is on term, we get Kyle Gibson and Miles Michaelis. The Eric Fetty trade at the deadline made sense. It didn't. I don't know why it was like the only thing that happened, really, but they send Tommy Pham out, who's now been cut and goes to the Royals. They send out Tommy Edman, who's been killing it for the Dodgers, and Eric Fetty comes in. Obviously, part of the draw with Fetty is he's also under contract fairly affordably next year. How is he fit? What have you seen from Eric Fetty since he came over?
Yeah, I think Eric Fetty is a perfect fit for the Cardinals. You think ground ball guy, sits mid to low to mid 90s, can log innings for you and knows how you got out of trouble. Oh, then you probably think about the St. Louis Cardinals. So good fit for Fetty. I mean, he certainly hasn't had the same success stat-wise here as he did with the White Sox, which is a little baffling. I'm not sure how you can have any sort of positive stats playing for the White Sox, but he did, and that's testament to him. But it's just been a difficult transition period. I think the team after the trade deadline was re-energized by getting Eric Fetty and Tommy Pham. And then things just took a terrible turn in August when they kind of just spiraled out of contention from there. What the organization likes about Fetty, minus what he does on the field, is the fact that he was only $7.5 million for 2025. This is a team that really likes to be frugal when it comes to pitching. So they at least know that they'll have him under wraps for 25 as well at a very cost-friendly deal. Brandon Donovan's emergence, we're seeing Sejacy come back up. That made Tommy Edman expendable. It's not something they necessarily wanted to do. But at the time, Edman hadn't played all season. He was recovering from elbow surgery. Edmund was also due to make over $8 million in arbitration next year, so they did save money, and that is probably saying the quiet part out loud for this organization. In trading Edmund for Fetty, you certainly want to see Tommy Pham's situation pan out better here, but he wanted to play every day, and that was not the role the Cardinals were going to use him at. So they did right by Tommy to let him go, and now you see him tearing up for the Royals. They're probably thinking, wow, I wish he could have done that here. And Tommy's probably saying, well, he could have if he played every day. So just, you know, I thought it was a good trade at the time. I thought it was very crafty for John Mozeliak, their president of baseball operations, to get two guys and also trim payroll. It just didn't work out.
Yeah, Tommy Pham being unhappy about something. I'm shocked. I can't believe it. I can't believe Tommy Pham was not thrilled about a situation. Okay, you mentioned earlier Ryan Helsley. He has 44 saves. He is tied with Emmanuel Clase for the most in baseball. And then nobody else even has 36. Nobody else has more than 36. So these guys are just like cruising to the Rolaids Relief Award or whatever it's called these days. What's gone into that? Like they haven't played that many close games. I know Helsley's good, but it's like you kind of alluded to, a little odd to see the top closer by far come from a team that's going to finish the season around 500.
I think it's one, how they've structured their bullpen usage. They have for the first time in a long time, scripted roles for their high leverage relievers. Helsley is getting the save situation every single time, and it's worked out well. Helsley's the type of guy, elite talent, obvious flamethrower kind of arm, but he likes to know when he's going to pitch so he can plan and execute. So if it's any time a save situation or the Cardinals have a chance to win the game in the ninth, he's coming in. St. Louis has also played, their margin of error is so slim. They have played a ton of close games, and their wins almost always come by only one or two runs. So when you look at, I think they've won 73 games at this point, 74 now after yesterday. Ryan Helsley has pitched in 51 of them. So goes to show just how close these wins are. And I think Helsley's really done a nice job of embracing that pressure. We saw it in 2022, what kind of closer he could be. I didn't love the way they used him in 23 as kind of a, like, whenever the game is at its best leverage point, because it's kind of hard to script when that could be. Mm-hmm. Impossible, actually. So now that he knows exactly when he's coming in, he'll be used in the ninth, and it allows for the setup men to be prepared as well. You're seeing better seasons from Andrew Kittredge, Jojo Romero, Ryan Fernandez has been a nice pickup for them, Rule 5 draft. It's just all around led to what we talked about earlier in the show, a really effective bullpen, and that goes to Helsley, really, for holding it down in the ninth.
The Cardinals, 27-18 in one-run games. The Blue Jays, 17-26. So guess who I'm picking if there's a one-run game this weekend. It's not going to go the Blue Jays' way, probably. Katie, thank you so much for taking the time out. I'll see you down at the park later.
You got it, Blake. Can't wait. Have a great day.
Katie Wu of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all the great work there. Yeah, some really good stuff on some of those prospects that have come up, some of those prospects that have gone down. Fascinating team with honestly a lot of parallels to the Blue Jays team in terms of expectations, the way things have gone, trying to play out the string here with an eye toward 2025, even though you've got a couple vets in the lineup every day, trying to figure out, you know, hey, is this guy the strong side of a platoon next year? Is he a bench piece next year? Is he AAA depth next year? Is he superfluous and maybe you trade him to address another need? The Cardinals have had that last part a couple times. You know, like, I feel like they finally traded Dylan Carlson this year after 3 or 4 years of teams being like, could we have Dylan Carlson? If you have Lars Nootbaar now, you don't need Dylan Carlson. We'll see if the Rays can fix him. And then Tommy Pham being a part of the Remember Some Guys army on that Royals team. Okay, we got a 7 o'clock game tonight. We'll set you up for that in just a second. Richard from Ajax in the text line said, anyone who plays Althea by the Dead is God. Awesome. Great show. Keep it up. Thanks. Had to get some Grateful Dead in there today. It is Grateful Dead night down at the ballpark. And one last text in the text line from earlier this week that I forgot to get to. Jeremy in the Junction asked, recalled in the spring, Bichette was talking about his shift in approach to try to pull the ball more, to add more power to his hitting. Did this attempt torpedo his season to some extent? I think it probably had an impact early on. It's something Chris Black and I broke down when the slump was maybe a month long. You know, are you trying to pull in the air too much? Should you go back to hitting it at all fields? By the time he got hurt and hit the IL, there was no like single thing like this. He was just all over the place as a hitter. And I still maintain he's going to get back to it. He is, again, been a 290, often 300 guy his entire career so far, led the league in hits twice. I'm going to bet that Bo Bichette figures it out as a hitter. But in terms of diagnosing what had happened earlier this year, by the time he hit the IL, nothing was going right. The two-strike approach was okay, and everything else was kind of all over the place. Eric Fetty against Kevin Gausman. Eric Fetty, I think we told the story when he was pitching against the Blue Jays for the White Sox. 31-year-old, went to Korea last year, came back, got a 2-year deal, looked much improved. He's sporting a 3.39 ERA. The underlying metrics aren't that strong, but they're still pretty solid. 92nd percentile run value on the breaking ball, so that's good. Gets good extension down the mound. So, you know, even though he's not going to light up the radar gun, he's one of those funkier guys. He'll go sinker, sweeper, cutter to righties, cutter, sinker, changeup, sweeper to lefties. The Jays did see him in May, got to him for 5 runs in 6 innings, but only 4 of those guys that played are still around. Vlad, 2-for-7 with 3 walks against him career, and Varsho, 3-for-7 with a pair of home runs. So maybe Varsho sees something there. On the Gausman side, as our pal Chris Black tweeted out earlier, the home road splits are really more about the good team, bad team splits. The Cardinals are the 24th ranked offense in baseball, so maybe it's a good spot for Gausman. Although the Cardinals, who will be active tonight, really have some success against Kevin Gausman. Historically, 3.14 average, 4.90 slug, and barely any strikeouts, with a lot of walks for a couple of those key guys as well. Okay, this has been a fun week. Thank you to Keegan Matheson, John Becker, David Singh, Esteban Rivera, and Katie Wu for joining us today. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, Jake Schultz, and Jennifer Rolnick for helping out behind the glass. Hope you all have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday at 10 a.m.